Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Guy, Jesus died this week.
Yes, no, I heard that's right. Give it 3 days. No, sorry, joking aside.
Those
who don't
know,
Gary is talking about the legendary character who was at, I mean, how he had managed to do it. He was at every gig you ever went to.
Yeah,
if you went
yeah.
to the Greyhound in Fulham Road, he was there. You went to the Hope and Anchor, he was there. You went to Reading Festival, he was there.
Apparently, he got up and played. He used to have long blonde hair. And he used to wear white. He was a classic hippie, white kind of caftanny type things. And people used to shout Jesus from the bleachers, and he would wave back at you. Played a tambourine. He apparently got on stage with Pink Floyd at the Roundhouse and played flute on Atom Heart Mother.
What?
Yeah, I read this in an article recently. But he would then, you know, I'd see him at Man gigs and, you know, Genesis or whatever, you know, you were going to. And then later on, I'd see him at punk gigs.
He'd no, as I'm saying, I remember seeing him at the
dance.
In fact, I think I saw him, of all things, I remember seeing Simon Townsend playing, and we had this great band. He had Tony Butler and Mark Brzezinski, who might come up later, in his band. And I remember seeing him at the Greyhound in Fulham Road, and Jesus was there.
Anyway, his name was William Jellett, and RIP, and God rest his soul. I mean, I feel
absolutely.
Like a little bit of music history has gone from the audience. Wonder if he ever danced at a Level 42 show.
I bet he did. I bet he did.
Another bass player comes into the show.
Yeah. Today.
A little bit threatened, guy. Yeah, I can see that on your face.
I'm very threatened. I'm nervous. I'm on edge. I'm pretty very insecure. Very, very insecure.
All right, let's get him on. Welcome to the Rock on Tours.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
Well, it's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
You know, what people forget about Bowie is that he was such a kind man.
Remember me? I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
Something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock on Tours podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Hey, guys, it's very nice to see you both. And, you know, that over the years I've known you, I was just thinking about Gary, do you remember coming to Miraval Studios in the south of France? It would have been about 1989. You were looking for somewhere to record, and we happened to be in there at that time. 1989, like I said.
And, no, it was earlier than that. It was earlier than that because it was...
Oh, it wasn't, but 1988, you're right. It was 88.
I think it was 86 because it was when we were mixing Through the Barricades album.
It was definitely 88, mate.
But, was it? Was it? Oh,
yeah.
Christ, what do I know?
You're not going to fall out over this, are you?
Yeah, that's it. I'm off. But anyway, it's a long time ago, mate. And
So we went to Miraval, and I don't remember coming to see you. I was with, must have been with Tony Swain or something. Gary Langan. Gary Langan, of course. And we were going to be doing one of those, the last two albums. And you were in there, and did we hang out?
Yeah, well, you came over, you had dinner with us. We were sort of heads down working, so I was coming in and out as we were doing bits, because I was quite desperate to get the album finished, which we got
what
done.
Album in, was it?
It was Staring at the Sun album, and Boone was down there writing with us, and we'd also been running through some other guitarists, and I'm not sure if Al Murphy... was there at that point in time, Gary, but that was the first time we worked with Al Murphy, was in that studio. And it was a lovely old place. I don't know if you do remember it, but I don't know if you've ever worked there, Guy. It's an old...
I think I have. That's the Chateau place, right?
Yeah.
I talked about it on my last lockdown mix, because funnily enough, I recorded there with Gary Moore, with Gary Husband.
Did you really? Well, Gary was there... It was. Yeah. It's a tale of Gary's, because Gary Husband was in the band with us then, and it's an old vineyard, and it was actually it was turned into a studio by Jacques Lussier, Right. I don't know if any of you, do you remember him? He was the sort of French jazz pianist who looked very like Abraham Lincoln. He had this sort of this nice beard, and he used to.
It's nice. I'm not sure. I never came close to it.
Yeah, nobody wears beards anymore. Well, except for you, Guy, of course. But anyway, when we left there, the studio manager very kindly gave us a case of the wine that they produced there.
Oh, and, it was amazing, wasn't it? It was amazing.
Just a beautiful place. The wine was vile, but the studio
The wine, it was the rosé, right? Which was great there. But then, of course, everyone made the mistake of getting a few cases to take home, and rosé just doesn't travel.
It didn't last at home either. And this was sort of before I was really into my wine. And we kept it on the top shelf in the kitchen, which was red hot. So by the time we finally got round to opening a bottle, which was about 4 years later, it just came out like syrup.
Can I just say about the wine? Because I've got first-hand experience of this particular bottle vintage. We used to drink it.
Well, hand over to our sommelier.
They used to give us wonderful lunches out on the on the veranda.
That's right.
And there was cats walking on the table when everyone was eating, and we always used to drink the wine there. And I think Tony Hadley only went to the studio because of the wine, but that studio then got bought by Brad Pitt and Angelina,
who then changed the name of the wine to Pink Floyd because it was Floyd had done some of the Wall recordings.
How about that? Hey, you see? Isn't it amazing? But it was a beautiful place, and I got such strong memories of one, finding a scorpion in my shoe in the morning, because there was all kinds of wildlife littering around, and hearing the frogs croaking in the evening as the sun was going down. It was a beautiful place, a nice place to work.
Anyway, we digress. So you're in the Isle of Wight.
Yeah, on the Isle of Wight in lockdown.
That studio looks like it takes up most of the Isle of Wight, actually.
it's just this cheap camera makes it look like that, you know?
Is it an estate agent's camera that makes every room look sort of...
Yeah, estate agents and pornographers. It makes everything look massive, so, you know, it's cool.
Look at a machine head on that. I used to love alum sands when we were kids, because we'd get those wonderful... variable coloured sands.
Yeah, I did a school trip from my London primary, and we went and stayed in this little B&B. And I remember we got taken around the Britain Norman factory,
where they
made the Islander and the Trilander. We went to Island Bay.
Yeah, well, the kids would go away with these little test tubes full of the coloured sands. You used to be able to buy the empty test tube and then sort of walk around and fill it up with these, because there are so many sort of stratas of sand going up the cliffs there. And the thing is that they started running out, so they actually ship the sand in these days. And there's somebody sitting there with like food colouring, like chucking it in the sand, just to kind of make the whole thing work.
There should be a sort of amnesty of sand, should there, of alum sands. Everyone sends in their alum sands. They can put it all back in again.
Yes, exactly. Can we have it all back now, please? Yeah.
Yeah, but separating the colours out from your tube, that would be a...
So the only other sort of famous people I can think of from the Isle of Wight was Julia Margaret Cameron, the 19th century photographer.
Yeah,
and Tennyson used to live there as well, didn't he?
Alfred Lord Tennyson lived it. Charles Dickens had a gaff too. They all sort of lived along the southwest coast of the Isle of Wight, which is beautiful and very windswept. And Dickens, there's one place in Bonchurch that he's reputed to have written one of his famous novels in. Who wrote Black Beauty as well, because that was also written in Bonchurch. So around this sort of this Gothic period, this early 1840s period, the Isle of Wight was quite the place to be. And
funnily enough, Mark, according to Bruce Robinson, his very, very convincing book, They All Loved Jack, he reckons he found the real Jack the Ripper, who was actually the most popular songwriter of the age, who, after all his ripping, went and retired to the Isle of Wight.
Now, that's an interesting thing, Guy. Another interesting thing, because I had a bar in Ryde, and when I was sort of fitting the bar up with, paintings and junk on the walls, because I just wanted to look busy, we went to a local auctions, and we bought this portrait of this couple, And he was sort of reputed to have been the mayor of Ryde, but there was a lot of talk too that he was Jack the Ripper. And it was just this old thing from, you know,
because he wrote his most popular song was called They All Love Jack.
And was all it really? You sure? You're not getting this muddled up with Spinal Tap, are you? You know, he's a saucy one.
So the question this is leading up to is, other than Level 42, what other band has ever come out of the Isle of Wight?
The Bees was a really good band from the 90s.
I said whatever other band has ever come out of the other. I don't remember the Bees.
Yeah, the Bees were...
they didn't exist, Gary.
the Bees are a fantastic band. It's worth checking out. You know, Sunshine Hit Me is a great album. It's really worth checking out. Who else? Craig Douglas, the singing milkman. He was sort of hitting the charts in the early 60s.
Wow.
Yeah, he was.
Was he an inspiration of yours, Mark? Because you were, in fact, a milkman, weren't you?
I was a milkman, yes. There's definitely something themic about
did,
this.
Did his records go gold top?
Hey! Absolutely. That's very good, Gary. Yeah, I like that.
Sorry, our writers aren't in this week.
You know, who else lives here? Benedict Cumberbatch has got a gaff here. Steve Lomax, Mrs., comes from the Isle of Wight as well. There's a lot of people here, and I think a lot of it is because the island has. A very good friend of mine, Michelin starred chef Chris Galvin's got a place in Cowes, and a lot of people do have holiday homes here. So between Seaview, Benbridge, Cowes, and Yarmouth, I mean Rob the Bank, Rob and Josie, they live over here. John Giddings lives down here.
There's
a lot of people in the industry that do seem to like living here on the Isle of Wight. It's a nice place, you know.
Who in Level 42 came from the Isle of Wight? Because you didn't actually form the band until you came to London and worked at Macari's, right? In the end.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. There were the brothers Gould, Phil and Boone, who, but you know, we became the very best of mates because, as always with bands. You know, you meet up because you have similar tastes in music, and we absolutely adored the jazz fusion and all the bits from the sort of the 1970s and jazz funk and jazz fusion. So we used to get together and talk about, you know, drummers, really. I wanted to be a drummer very much at that time.
Talking of which, I've got to interject here because I want to hear, you've got to tell this story, Mark, which I love, is because you, like me, like so many of us, were a Laker kid, right? And you flew to America when the cheap Freddie Laker flights, right? As I did in that. And why did you fly to America, Mark?
I flew to America because I wanted to join Return to Forever, which was Chick Corea, Stan Clark, Lenny White and Aldo Meola at that particular point in time. And I wrote to Lenny when I was 15 years old, I think, 16 maybe. And a year later, I got a letter back. And it's a fantastic
letter. Post was terrible then, wasn't it?
I still have, yeah, that's right. You think the post's slow now, you want to go back to 74, 76. But Lenny was lovely and he wrote... He just gave me, you know, it was just like a single thing, but I've got it hanging on the wall in the house because it was such a lovely letter and was one of those sort of seminal moments for me because this great musician that I thoroughly admired and aspired to be like him took the time to write back, you know, and he just gave me this bit of advice. The last bit, it just said, remember, Mark, a man makes his own chances. Now, when you're sort of 15 years old, you sit there reading and, you know, grilling through everything. And I thought, what does he mean? And he'd written his name and address at the top of the letter, as everybody does anyway. But I took this to mean that he wanted me to go to New York. So this, as you said, Guy, this was just when Freddie Laker had launched the, you know, cheap flights to the States. And this was 1970.
You took your own lunch. You took your own lunch, right? Remember?
Yeah. That's it. It was real budget stuff.
It was sort of a cross between sort of Richard Branson and Reg Varney. You know.
It was a bit. Yeah, they used to. They had conductors walking up and down the aisle that you could actually. You know, do you want to return? Do you want to get off here? It was, but it was good, and it got me to the States. And unfortunately, when I got to New York, I hadn't sort of made much planning, and showed up at Lenny White's house, and his wife, who was charming, answered the door, and she said, you know, and I said, oh, I'm come from the Isle of Wight. I wrote Lenny a letter, and she said, oh yeah, the guy from the Isle of Wight, how lovely, you know. And I said, is Lenny in? And she said, no, he's in California, and it's like, you know, 3,000 miles away, and. I think the look on my face, I think my lip was going, and she was lovely. She said, look, Mark, you know, if you leave me a number, she said, he's back, you know, he's back in 6 days' time, and he will give you a call. And, man, he did. And he invited me over to his place, and so I got to meet him. And Don Blackman, who was sort of produced the album with him and was a fantastic keyboard player, invited me in, played me the album that they'd just been mixing in California. It took me to his basement where, and like, I saw his drums.
How old were you then?
I just turned 17. So,
you just died.
It's incredible. So, I mean, you as musicians, you would know how important that is to a young guy, because he didn't get to hear me play or anything, which is probably a good thing, but. It was lovely because the next time I met Lenny, which is like winding forward, you know, to sort of 1986, 87, was he came to see a show of ours when we played Wembley Arena. And was just awesome that I could say to him, thank you so much. And, you know, one of the reasons that I'm here is because you were such a gentleman, you know. I hate to add that anybody that turns up to my house gets told to fuck off because it's private.
Especially any Isle of Wight singing milkman.
Yeah, there's not a lot of call for it, Gary. You know,
Mark, how did you end up being a jazzer at such an early age, really? I mean, if you end up playing kind of like you were part of that jazz funk movement, but you were more jazz than funk, really, weren't you, at that stage in your life?
Certainly, that was the thing for me. My route through it, Gary, was really, you know, I was sort of drumming. I got my first drum kit. Mum and Dad got me when I was 9. And I was so into Cream then, because Ginger Baker was this phenomenal drummer. And of course he's a jazzer, and there was Jack Bruce was in the band. And
because I saw when you played that Jack Bruce tribute, and obviously, I mean, I've always been in awe of your playing generally, but this was a whole side you've never put out. You had that Jack Bruce thing just down, inside out, upside down. And it was amazing.
Oh, well, that's very kind of you, Guy. Yeah. I did go. I don't know if you can see on the back of the wall there. I've got this old.
Yeah, the EB. You got the EB3.
Yeah, there it is. This old one, which I went and got this especially for that gig, because, you know, being a massive fan, and Jack's family were very sweet and said, did I want to come and play a couple of songs? So I thought, well, I want to do it like Jack would have done it, you know. And so playing this bass and being on stage and, you know, getting to play with Ginger Baker, albeit briefly, for me, a dream come true.
I work with Ginger. It was
It's an experience, isn't it? Yeah. You know, it's great.
That's definitely the way to put it.
Yeah. But it's OK, because, you know, he's Ginger Baker and all of that great stuff. So getting back to what you were talking about, Gary, that's where I was coming from. You know, as a kid, and then of course I because the drums thing, and then I got to see Buddy Rich was on Parkinson show, and I sort of saw that for the first time, and it was just blew me away that there was this sort of level of dexterity on the instrument and stuff, and as a kid there are no sort of limits. You know, we didn't have the luxury of YouTube or any of that, where it was easy to get this stuff. You happened to stumble upon it either on TV or if John Peel was playing something and you happened to sort of listen in on that.
And you'd only hear it the once.
So hang on, now what are we up to? Are we up to you meeting the brothers
absolutely. Like Boone and Phil, Phil was a fantastic drummer here on the island. And, he was quite a name. Well, one of the benefits of growing up as an aspiring young musician on an island is that you can kind of, your boundaries are quite small, because there's this small circle of musicians that play. So it's, you know, I don't know if people realize how competitive musicians are, particularly in the, you know, when they're starting out. And it's always this thing to be, you know, I think I'm better than him. I want to be better than him. I want to be, I just want to be the best.
You found the idea that everyone would, I guess everyone was fusion heads, right? In such a small place.
Yeah, well,
so into fusion.
Yeah,
they were the guys, but that's why we hung out together. I mean, I knew plenty of musicians who weren't into fusion, that I would be playing with as well. But it just so happened that those were the guys, so we hung out together, and it was a lovely thing, and we stayed sort of great friends until we all moved to London, and then you know got something going.
Yeah, but there's never in the history of music has two drummers met up and gone, let's form a band. You know, I mean, you were both.
That ended well, anyway.
it ended well. You know, I mean, you don't want to step into the Gary Glitter two drummers thing, really. You know, with but
hang on, your mate was a drummer as well, so one of you had to give, right?
Yeah, well, and do you know what swung it was the fact that I had my drums nicked on a sort of failed attempt at greatness with a band in Austria.
That's a little thing that I've seen only a sentence about. I'm intrigued about this. What was the band in Austria?
Yeah, well, you know...
Do you not want to go there?
Well, no. As you said earlier, Gary, you know, I was working in Macari's music shop because, you know, Mike...
Yeah, Linder, sickening. This is why you learned the bass. This is quite sickening to me.
No, this is just how it was.
Mark, by the way, before I say any more, did you know that Guy is a bass player?
Well, I heard he was a bass owner.
Because you know, my dad bought me my first bass from Macari's.
Oh wow!
Did he really? Yeah.
Yeah, but that would have been 19. That was 1975. You wouldn't be there then, would you?
No, I wasn't there then. I was there sort of 78.
Yeah, you could have sold my dad. No, but let's just invent the myth that you sold my dad my first bass.
That's
let's
it.
Go with that.
One of the many outcomes of COVID is that Macari's has finally shut down after all these years.
It sort of
went into liquidation last year. So that was really sort of sad to see. Somebody tweeted me and I was very sorry to see that go. But I was working in the music shop. They didn't sell drums, but I was able to get to see a lot of the traveling guys that were coming in doing the shows and things through the West End. And so obviously, you know, lunchtimes and things like that in the afternoons, you get these gigging bass players that come in and they'd say, you know, let me see that Fender on the wall or let me try this or something. And you know, a couple of them were slapping the bass. Now I was really into Stan Clark. So I was thinking, that's the sound. That's the thing that I like, you know? Yeah. And so it was just a simple thing of then, you know, as soon as they'd gone, I was sort of say, look, you know, don't waste our time, mate. Off you go. They had no intention of mine. But I'd take the bass in the back and sit down and just start slapping it around. Go, you know, and just within a couple of months, there were, you know, an Austrian guy came into the shop, said, did I fancy, you know, and we were talking and he was talking about Chick Corea and he played this little thing on the piano. And I just said, this is great. He said, I've come to London looking for musicians. And I said, well, I'm a drummer. You know, and he said, oh, we're looking for a drummer, you know, so do you want to join the band? And I went with a guy called Bill Leesgang, who's a really good guitarist, and he was working in the other branch of Macari's. So we both left Macari's, went to Austria in the back of the van, and went to join this band. That lasted about three or four months. We were living out there, right in a really harsh winter. It was freezing cold, just dreadful. And it ended up with me losing my drums, my vinyl collection, and every bit of clothes I stood up in. So I just managed to get a ticket back to London, came home sort of empty-handed. Just a classic struggling musicians story. Yeah. You know, with the help of all my mates, you know, once again, you know, Phil and Boone, and then I got to meet Mike Lindup, and there we go. And they would give me clothes, and I was crashing on, you know, friends' floors and stuff. So it was... You know, this wasn't sort of a rags to riches thing, but that, Gary, you see, is why when we got together and we met Mike, and Mike said, you know, there's a rehearsal room at the Guildhall School of Music, let's go up there and jam. They got plenty of instruments. So I was borrowing an old Gibson EBO bass, which was the sort of the semi-acoustic.
Semi-hollow, yeah.
Yeah. And this is where, Guy, I got that thing about you always using really, really light gauge strings, because they were all short scale.
I can't believe how light yours are. I can't believe.
Yeah, it's 30, 50, 17.
That's how he does it. I'm always looking for excuses why you're so much better than me.
But no.
Your style, Mark, must have come out of the fact you're a drummer, because it's so percussive. What you're doing is almost what you would do on a set.
Yeah, it's very much high. Well, it's hi-hat technique, isn't it? Especially the two-handed slap thing.
Absolutely.
I've never quite mastered. Right.
It's very kind of you to say that, Gary. You know, for me, it was quite easy, because the whole thing, as you were saying, Guy, is very much the 16th thing. So, you know, everything I do, it's two hands. So it's much more akin to playing congas or bongos. And then you just translate that to the instrument. And you're going, and it's that whole, that 16th vibe that's going through, which at the time worked good for what we were doing musically, you know, and it certainly seemed to fit with the whole jazz fusion that we were hearing coming over from the States. So, it was a good bit of bad fortune, if you like. It was something good that came out of the fact that I'd lost the drums. So
Stanley Clark was your man, was he?
Stan Clark was the guy. And it was, but also, Gary, it was the relationship that he had with Lenny on drums and Chick Corea. And I think that the great lesson for me, I'm known as being a bass player, but I've never sort of said I'm a bass player. I've always thought of myself as a musician. but as a just an all round musician, because I'm just in awe of, John McLaughlin and these guys, and our good friend Gary Husband, whose name comes up again, is just such a phenomenal musician.
Yeah, I mean, it's extraordinary to see him play when he goes from, well, there was that famous thing of when he was a kid on Nationwide or something, isn't it? Going from piano to drums.
I saw that guy, it was on a Yorkshire TV program called Anything You Can Do, that used to be on about 4:30 on a Tuesday afternoon or something like that, certainly down here, on BBC South. And I can just remember getting in from school and, switching on the TV. And it was Anything You Can Do, Here's a Chance to Be the Best. Yeah. This kid was like, there was just this kid who sort of had a shaved head and specs and was sitting on a piano, and he was just all over it. And then the bastard had the temerity to get off the piano, go to a kit of drums, beat seven bells.
Well, swung round. I think it was even worse.
Just seven bells out, got around there, and then jumped back on the piano. And I stood there with my jaw on the floor. I'd have been about 14 years of age thinking, swine, this is what I want to do.
Jeremy Stacey is the only other musician I know, drummer who plays keyboards at the same time, doesn't he?
Does he? I don't know.
He plays with King Crimson.
He does that with King Crimson, in fact, which is where there's another link.
Well, you see, I can deliver milk and play bass at the same time. That's about the bass.
No, mate, you can play the bass to Love Games and sing it at the same time, which is...
another reason is because nobody else would do it in the band. It was just a... we all started out, the idea of singing to any of us wasn't something that was on the cards.
An interesting moment.
I know, you're way too cool. I can really see that thing with that kind of, you're just too cool, weren't you, to sing?
You were instrumental jazz funkers, serious musicians.
Yeah.
I don't want to say musos. You may have all ended up as session players, never in a pop band that was going to sell out multiple nights at Wembley Arena. And so you're doing that jazz thing, but then there's also down the road, there's Brit funk starting. There's the whole sort of...
There is, Gary.
Then there's a sort of new romantic, which is sort of post-punk disco going on over the other side.
And this is where you guys were coming in, because, that there was definitely a cross-pollination, that if you look back to the early music of Spandau and... because we're talking sort of 82, 83, earlier, 81, 82. And, cut a long story short and et cetera, et cetera. There was a lot of this cross-pollination, but only that where you guys were nailing it, which didn't occur to us, was that you kind of had an image thing going on. And that for us was just like, fucking hell, that's a good idea. But, you know, we were kind of too late into it. So we were just stood there. Our very first promo shots that were taken for the first record, I was wearing a shirt that my mama bought for me when I was on my 18th birthday. And it was, you know, you always used to have your favorite shirt and stuff. And it was, and because, you know, because of course you had to make all this stuff go. That was a shirt I saved for best. So when we had
that's my album sleeve shirt.
Mom. Yeah, it was. It was
a shirt. Well, that's Haircut 100, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I suppose it is. Yeah, yeah. Favorite.
No, I think my point was, when did you or who suddenly said to you, why don't you start to sing and make pop records?
It was our first producer, Andy Soiker, who he was the guy that had come along and heard us sort of rehearsing, and we were rehearsing in a studio, which very kindly paid for by Robin Scott. Because Phil
from M.
Yeah, M. That's pop, right.
Pop, oh yes, that's right. Yeah.
That's exactly it. And the connection here was is that John Gould, who became our first manager, he was working at MCA Records, doing you know, press or promotion or something. And he was the older brother of Phil and Boone. And M needed a drummer to go on Top of the Pops. And John said, you know, look, my brother plays drums. And Robin said, oh, he'll be fine. You know, let's get him in. So that Phil suddenly from, you know, being my best mate and this, that and the other, Bastard was on Top of the Pops. And it was like, oh, wow, it's this easy. This is what happens is that 1 minute you're starving, eating ready break with hot water, you know, in a squat in Walthamstow. Next thing, your mate's on Top of the Pops, and that's how it's done. Anyway, Robin very kindly sort of paid for a couple of days of rehearsal, and we were in the studios, rehearsal rooms. In the next room to us was Light of the World, which was Bluey, of course, you know.
Yeah, and the guys from Beggar and Co, who played on our record, Chant Number
There
One.
You go, and all of these guys were in the next room to us. So, and it was just bizarre because, you know, we was just stood jamming in this room. And the door suddenly opened, and in came Bluey and all the guys, and Tubbs, the bass player, and all the horn players, and they're going, "Man, what's going on?" And it's you know, well, that's how it seemed to me. None of them spoke with an American accent, by the way, but
in Tottenham accent.
In my mind's eye, that's how it went, you know. And it's lovely because, you know, you as the years go by, you become friends with all of these guys, and you meet, you know, you meet them all, you hang out with them, and you know, I'm looking forward to working with Bluey at some point in the future.
So hang on, Robin said you should sing.
No, Robin didn't, but our first producer, Andy Soiker, he came down to this rehearsal because we kind of used this time. That was the whole point of having this rehearsal room, is that we get somebody in. And John Gould, once again, knew this guy who had this a band called Atmosphere, and they had a record, they had a hit called Dancing in Outer Space, which was on Andy's label. All Ears Music, I think it was, All Ears, something like that. They were working out of Harlesden in North London. And Andy was a very go-ahead guy for the time. And he had sort of had his finger on the pulse of this whole sort of Brit funk thing that was coming through, and the funk mafia, the DJs that were playing this stuff. So Andy came in, heard, you know, we played sort of five instrumentals, and you know, he didn't really like four of them. He did like one, which was the riff to a song called Love Meet in Love.
It's Love Meet in Love. That's right.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Because this, we're skipping over, because by now you've already had Dominic Miller in the band.
Yeah, Dom. Well, Dom was Mike's best mate at the Guildhall School of Music. And Dom, you know, Mike said, "Oh, you know, I've got this guy." Because Boone wasn't. There was sort of me hanging out with Mike and me hanging out with Phil. Mike was there. I'm not sure Boone had even moved to London by this time. But anyway, Dom was Mike's best mate at the Guildhall, and he sort of came down. We did about two Monday nights rehearsals, Tuesday nights or whenever it was, that in the room. And then the third time he didn't show up. And then, you know, because he's a proper musician.
This is the one topic, because Dom's a dear old friend of mine, and I've toured with him. In fact, and so I've had to play your bass parts, because when you played on his... when you played on his album. So,
that's right.
I had to get a bloody five string out. But funny, but the joke I used to have about the tour, because of course Mike Lindup was in the band. And my joke was, I said, this is the most Muso tour I've ever done. And you know you're in trouble when the Level 42 song is the easy one in the set.
You know, recording that album with Dom was lovely guy, because we did the whole thing in a couple of days, just a couple of afternoons. And it was lovely working with Ian Thomas, was playing drums.
Oh, yeah, Yanto.
And he's such a fantastic drummer.
Yeah,
and so, it just made the whole thing really easy for me. And it was that I kept thinking of Jimmy Johnson, who's another sort of hero bass player of mine.
Played with Alan
Holdsworth and stuff.
And by the way, you are appearing on today, for the first time, we were the number one music podcast on Apple.
Fantastic, guys.
Yeah, mate.
That's amazing.
I think having a number one podcast is the middle-aged version of having a number one single.
It's pretty fucking cool. I'll tell you that. It's lovely. Yeah, well done, you know, well deserved. I got a call actually from Tarquin the other day. And, you know, he said that because he's involved with this somehow, isn't he?
He is, that's right, yeah.
Well, Tarquin looks after Stu Copeland. And,
that's right, yeah.
And I did a thing with Stuart.
Gizmodrome.
Yeah, Gizmodrome.
I mean, that is the most fucking bonkers supergroup I've ever heard of.
You know, it was lovely because we recorded the album in the studios owned by the keyboard player from PFM. And
I remember them. That's an old Italian prog band.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And funnily enough, Mark, what's his name, on Six Music was just happened to be rapping about PFM the other night and going on about them, you know, sort of what an important band they were. So it was just great to be in this studio. And it really was a sort of a great old early 70s studio. It was just walls of amps. And Leslie cabinets and organs and all these kind of old keyboards.
Lava lamps.
but very nearly, there was lots of fluffy carpet everywhere.
No, but listen, listeners, if you've not heard this, get your head around. Mark King and Stuart Copeland is the rhythm section. I mean, you could go to war with that.
Adrian Ballou.
Adrian Ballou on guitar was nuts, you know. And Vittorio Cosma is just the coolest Italian guy, you know. As always, I mean, you know, that I'm talking to you working musicians now, and you know how much we rely. You know, we're kind of gobby and get in the place, but you always rely on really, really shit-up players in the studio around you who kind of just glue the whole thing together. You come up with some crazy idea. You know, Adrian Ballou is just barking. There's stuff pinging off the walls. And Vittorio just sort of managed to just pull it all together. So that was a very, very nice...
I was going to say, not a lot of chords.
Didn't you get some prog rock award, Mark?
Yeah, I did actually, Gary. Yeah, and I did. I got a prog rock award, and it's in the flat in London, but I haven't been to the flat in London for over a year, so it's probably been burgled.
Since Gary and I have been in this the Nick Mason's band, Sourceful of Secrets, and we've suddenly found ourselves, it's quite kind of, because when I work with Pink Floyd, they're sort of above, like, you know, your peers are sort of ABBA. And obviously, you know, Gary and I are used to very different worlds. And we've suddenly found ourselves in this world of prog, which is fantastic. And now seeing how there's this whole overspill of like, you know, there's so many connections with Level 42 into this, this prog world. It's funny.
It's all about sort of playing and just sort of playing really for the love of playing. What I love about prog is that nobody's, you know, that when you come out of this, when you come out of the idea of actually trying to compete with a place in the charts, and you know, that we sort of we fell into that cycle about sort of 1985 to 1987, you know, of having to come up with the goods to have a hit record. When that's gone, it's just a lovely thing. You can revert back to, you know, to the true thing, which is that you just like playing. And you know, playing is playing. You know, as Miles Davis said, there's two kinds of music. There's good music and bad music, you know, and it all works for me.
Because obviously what the kind of music you were making in the 80s, the regular music press, the sort of NME and Melody Maker sounds, you know, they never really ever wrote about funk, jazz funk, soul, disco. They hated it.
They did, yeah.
It was, to them, I think it was seen as a working class aspirational music and therefore not as politically sound as, say, reggae was. How did the press deal with this? these jazz?
No, we were always incredibly unhip as far as the popular press was going. I suppose about the hippest we'd have been, Gary, would have been when our very first record that we talked about earlier on, Love Meeting Love, that Andy Soyker had sort of picked up for us, was made, John Peel made it one of his top 10 records of 1980. And that's about the last
time.
That's
brilliant. That's great, because you can't argue with that. That's brilliant.
No, he did it, and there it is. It's done and dusted, you know. We were sort of seen as really the sort of the antithesis of what punk was about. And even at the time, you know, I remember going back then, I couldn't get my head around punk at all. As an older man with the blinkers off, because it doesn't matter anymore, I just like listening to music, I realised how great some of the punk bands were and how important they were. But they were the guys that really spoke to the music press and the, you know, the popular media at the time. And that was something that they couldn't get their heads around what we were doing, because they probably couldn't get their heads around the notes that were coming out, you know?
But, you know, and so
well, what's interesting, the only band who did actually manage to get away with that, and I always found it quite extraordinary at the times, because it's like, you know, the two bass players who were really affecting me, which was you and Norman, was the Enduring the Blockheads. I mean, you cannot get a more muso jazz funk band than that.
No,
and yet they were completely, because of Ian...
The Blockheads was a fantastic thing. You know, Chaz Janko did marvellous things.
That was punk meets jazz.
Yeah.
Punk,
yeah.
It but was, they completely got away with it. It was there, you know, if anyone else tried that.
And you know, too, there was, you know, also I love from the punk thing was like Susie and the Banshees, I thought were just an incredible band. And, you know, and when John McGeoch was in and playing guitar with them, he was just incredible guitar parts in there. And I was straight away making a connection between what John was doing and what John McLaughlin had been doing.
Absolutely.
Because there was all this amazing arpeggiated stuff that, you know, harmonically was really, really sophisticated. And
given that your sort of level of the musos, if you like, that's probably not under the nicest name, but
could you work on that, Gary, please?
The quality of musicians,
I'll carry that cross,
within your band, was everybody in the group happy with sort of commercial way you were going? And because you were writing pop songs that were incredible pop songs.
Probably not towards the end, you know, I think that Phil, you know, felt that we were going in a direction that he didn't want to go in. Unfortunately, it was being very successful. And that, you know, that for me was everything I'd seen to have been working towards, was that I don't see what's going wrong here, mate, because the band is being more and more successful. Unfortunately, the workload that was put on us was quite incredible. And, you know, when I look back and realise how Phil and Boone have both sort of risen to the task of, all right, look, we're coming up with these songs, we need lyrics. You guys write lyrics, you know, write them. And when you go into the studio and you work the way that we used to work, which was basically you make it up right there and then, you come in with the loosest of ideas. And, you know, when album time came around, you'd say, well, what you got? And, you know, I'd sort of pull out some ideas, you know, Mike would play some stuff and we just sort of mash it all together. And then it was like, well, let's top line it. So we'd la-di-da the whole thing. And then, great, right, boom, write some words for this. Phil, write some words for this, man. And that is incredible pressure. And it was all being done, like words were getting delivered to you on mic and stuff.
If you look at your discography, I feel like I spent most of the 80s with my feet up, because it was just amazing amount of very prolific.
That's right, a lot of hits.
And you worked with the two guys from Earth, Wind & Fire as well.
Yeah, we did. Yeah, that was sort of 83, Gary. That was for us. That was a sort of a kind of respectability that we got from them. That we sort of weren't seeing.
Larry Dunn and
Verdeen White.
Yeah.
And you know, Verdeen's fantastic bass player.
Yeah,
Larry Dunn was a marvelous, fantastic keyboard player and arranger. And Larry also produced an album for Lenny White. So all of this sort of this cross-pollination of, you know, Lenny was the guy I went to visit in 1976. It's an incredibly small world when you sort of start getting in that cycle of things. But working with Earth, Wind & Fire and working in their studio, the complex in Los Angeles, and being just in this vibe where, George Massenberg had a workroom there, so he was coming in with these flying faders and sort of showing us how this was working, and this was all sort of technology that was just on the cusp. And George Duke could walk in with Lewis Johnson, and because they're doing something exactly, you know, getting to shake their hands and stuff. And it's heady stuff when you're 23, 24 years old, and you're in the sunshine, and the whole thing's real. And you're with Earth, Wind & Fire,
Because you picked up Wally Badaroo really early on.
Yeah, because that's right. Wally Badaroo, who played with Robert Palmer and came out of that whole Nassau, Compass Point.
I remember living out at Compass Point.
Yeah, that's right. And because Wally was one of the Compass Point All-Stars.
That's right, yeah.
And Wally, of course, was he also played in M. So it was the Robin Scott connection. That's how that Phil got to meet Wally. Phil said, look, I've got this sort of fun band with the mates. Come along and have a listen. So Wally, from the very first record, Love Meeting Love, Wally's been involved with the band. And as we sort of worked through to 84, 85, 86, and we were having some sort of sizable hits internationally, Wally just always been the fifth member of the band. He just never worked live with us. That was all.
He was your Ian Stewart.
Yeah, he was the main man. He was.
The thing about your sound is, even though you were using American producers, the guys from Earth, Wind & Fire, is there was such a Britishness, an Englishness about your vocal.
Gary, this is what they wanted, though. This was the payoff for them, because they'd been touring. They were on tour in 1982, probably doing their last big tour. This is when they had the drum set going up on stage and going upside down, and everyone was walking in and out of these opening pyramids and the whole Egyptian thing. Massive shows. They were playing these arenas, all around the world. And it just happened to be that when they were in Germany, they heard from Polydor. They said, we have this new band, or Deutsche Grammophon, of course. It was as the Polydor in Germany was then. And so they heard it, and it was Larry and Verdeen, got in touch and said, would you guys be interested in, we'd love to produce a record with you. Are you up for that? We did. And of course, there was this thing of why they were interested in us is because they kept talking about this Euro thing, this European sound you got. And we, of course, the attraction for us was, fantastic. We can actually go and get the sound like the real thing now, So we kind of sat in the studio looking at each other going, well, how'd you do it then? You tell us. And they were going, well, no, you show us how you do the thing,
But also, because another funny thing for us, Mark, because because the 80s was the decade of the bass, right? It was the golden age of the bass.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
And we're talking about this British sound. For some reason this struck me earlier that because all the gear we were using, everything we were using was British. I mean, you and I both, you played JD basses and then Status basses, as I did, and we all played Trace Elliot amps. And there was none of this slavishness to Fender or anything. Everything we were doing was British.
Yeah, Rota Sound strings.
Elite, Bass Central Elite.
I've just grabbed that bass, actually, Guy. Hang on a sec.
Oh, come on.
This is the one.
This is.
This was the JD that the very first one. I love this. All the buckle rash and the crap
on it
was just worn out. And I got this in 19...
Give us a slap. Give us a slap.
Oh, you can't hear... Yeah, this bass I got with the first advance we got from Polydor, 1980. My share of it was £500. We got £5,000, which we had to buy a band's worth of equipment from.
Which in those days.
and a van. So I had 500 quid and walking up Shaftesbury Avenue, I went into Sounds. And I've been looking around and I was thinking about a Wild Bass or something like that.
Oh, yeah, of course.
But
yeah.
I just saw this and it had been on at the guitar show in London, the sort of music show that February. And, you know, they wanted 700 quid for it. But I just loved it because, one, it looked a bit like an alembic.
Looks like an alembic, exactly. Well, I thought it was when I first saw you playing it.
I think Alembic thought it was too, because then they a few years later, they came and they sort of made a couple of, a few basses for me, actually. But this one is lovely. It's like serial number 0003SA.
Mark, you've just bought that bass. Do you remember the first song that you would have slapped out on that with Level 42? What was the first thing you came up with that you went, wow, that's me. That's nobody else but Mark King.
Well, it would have been Love Games.
We all wanted to be that guy. That is the guy we wanted to be. That's what he wanted to do. And there's a bit of video has surfaced on YouTube, which is of someone just showing you around backstage at the Pink Floyd rehearsals in this aircraft hangar in Toronto in 1987. You can't see the stage, but you can hear me and Gary Wallace playing Love Games at the Pink Floyd rehearsal.
Oh, yeah, thank you, guy. That's nice to know, man. You know, that's really lovely to hear. The bass that I borrowed before that was this Gibson EBO, which, you know, had the fine strings on it. But this is a long scale.
Did you slap that? Did you slap an
yeah,
EBO?
Yeah, I did. I did. Wow. And it worked fine. You know, it was okay. But that's how I ended up with these really thin strings, because they didn't make 30, 50, 70 and 90 as sets. And particularly not in long scale. The reason they were that thin, because they were short scale. So that's where Rota Sound were fantastic, because back to this British equipment stuff.
Yeah.
You know, that those guys were, you know, I just got in touch with them and said, could you put together some sets of long scale of these for me? And they went, yeah, you know, and they did. And that's it. And I'm using them to this day, of course.
You obviously became the bass player of choice. You and probably, you know, Pino and Guy, you know, you three were always being asked to do sessions. I mean, you did the Midure album. Did they want you to be Mark King slapping the bass, or were you then having to accommodate for their style and finding out stuff about you?
Well, it's a very good point, Gary, because back then, sort of in context, I think they probably wanted me to do the Mark King slapping and noodling as much as I could within it, you know, that I know Midge was very happy for that to happen. And funnily enough, we go back to Chaz Jankel and the Blockheads. Mm-hmm. And I went and did, he was producing an album for Alexi Sale. You know that, Didn't You Kill My Brother and all that.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah,
I went
yeah.
and played a couple of tracks on that thing.
That's Steve, almost a singing milkman, isn't it?
Gold top. My Steve Lillywhite told my mate, I'm sort of friends with Matt Everett, who's a Six Music news guy. And Matt was, you know, that the we just sort of celebrated Bowie's passing. And he said, oh, Steve Lillywhite was just raving about, you know, when you came in and played on. And I've got no recollection of playing on a Bowie album. But everyone said, oh, no, that's definitely you. And Steve Lillywhite said it was definitely me. But, you know, other than the fact that you know, back then, of course, you know, because it was Bowie, it didn't mean he'd be in the studio when the stuff was being laid down. So it's quite possible that I would have been at the townhouse or wherever and just gone into the room next door and just jammed along. You know, I did with Nick Kershaw, you know, all of these sort of guys.
Do you know what track he played on for Bowie?
I don't know. I've got no memory of doing it whatsoever. But, you know, if I hear it, it even sounds
weird. The funny thing is, if people are listening, will be going, my God, how can that be possible? But I completely understand.
You understand, yeah?
Yeah, I totally understand. Yeah.
You know, there were things like when I did do Nick Kershaw's album, that which is how I met Julian Mendelson, who then came to engineer a lot of our successful stuff. Yeah. And he would have been at Miraval with us, Gary, when you sort of dropped in for dinner.
Julian worked for us with Trevor Horn, in the earlier
days. Yeah, that's it, because he was part of that whole Psalm thing. And they had you know, there was just this, Trevor had this great sort of series of three or four engineers and sound guys that he always worked with, with all these projects. But, you know, when I went in to do Nick's thing, I was laying seven bells out of whatever it was that Nick wanted me to do. And the door sort of came open and it was his missus. And she said, do you think you could turn the bass down? Because I'm watching, I'm watching Coronation Street or something.
We're making a hit record in here.
In the other room, yeah. So, you know, what are you going to do?
I played with you on stage in 87 at Wembley.
Yeah, that would have been one of the Prince's Trust things.
You played one of my songs, Through the Barricades. Me and Tony got up and did that. And Eric Clapton played guitar. Yeah. Phil Collins on drums. Yeah. And actually, I remember doing the rehearsal in the afternoon. And I think, I can't remember. Mark Brzezicki might have been playing drums in the rehearsal.
He would have been, for sure, yeah.
2 days before.
Yeah.
And then on the night, I'm doing Through the Barricades. It's all acoustic at the beginning. And then in the mid-late, the drums come in. These drums came in. I went, what was that? I turn around and it's Phil Collins who sat
Phil's,
in.
Phil's banging
and
you,
in fact, I was watching it just the other day. And I'd forgotten that we'd played together on that show.
You've just reminded me, actually. That was the thing, Gary. There were such sort of lovely events, those.
That's where you could have gone, Mark. No, I have no recollection of that whatsoever.
At the end of that show, Ringo and George Harrison got up and we all did...
They did.
A Little Help from My Friend.
Yeah, absolutely. And... yeah, that's it. It was great. And you know, my famous quote, I think George had been speaking to Nick Kershaw's wife because he came over to me and said, could you turn the bass down, please? which I had to do. But I had this whole line of Trace Elliott 4x10s under the drum riser, and it probably was horrendously loud, but there it is.
Yeah, and not very bassy. That was the thing, wasn't it? That was the thing. Everything was about punch.
Yeah, it was. Well, that's why I sort of used the 10-inch speakers guy, because it's know, the whole sort of 18-inch was just, you wouldn't go there with slap bass. You know, 15-inch you were pushing your luck, because they really...
Well, you've got to be standing 100 yards away to hear it.
Yeah, you have, yeah.
Well, maybe that's why in soul music and funk music, because the bass guitar and the guitar and the keyboards are all occupying the same area, you've either got falsetto guys or you've got the guys down here.
Yeah,
trying to get out of the way of the
big left-hand keyboard parts.
There are very few level 42 songs that don't have a synth bass actually fulfilling the proper low frequencies. If I'm fanning
doing
about
doing the job,
yeah, that's right, doing your job, guy.
I mean, how do guitarists cope with what you do? I mean, you've had some great guitarists playing with you over the years, but. Do guitarists ever feel, you know, hang on, I think, am I the guitarist or are you the guitarist?
Because if you're Dominic Miller, you just don't show up.
Yeah, that's right. Dom didn't show up at all. But this is where Boone Gould was fantastic, because that he, you know, was like, okay, you know, then what room's left here? Because, you know, that working with all the guys, you have to, it, you know, obviously if I've been writing a lick like the Love Games riff or something else, or 43, something like that, it's all quite busy stuff. And so it's like you either try and crash chords through it, or you sit there and you pick your moments and you pick your notes, you know, and that's what Boone was so brilliant at doing. And then, of course, that becomes the sound, Gary. And so from then on, it's all right. This is the template. This is kind of how it goes if you want to work. And we also did a lot of unison stuff too. So, you know, if it's fingerstyle riffs, then it'll be fingerstyle bass and guitar unisoning the same things, you know?
There's so much we've missed out. I mean, your first big tour was supporting the Police, right?
It was 1981. Now, yeah.
Did you actually become friendly with Stu? I mean, did you guys hang out?
Yeah, well, Stu, we had five shows, which was, you know, where Stu would come back and sneer at us, you know, which he's really good at doing, but only the way that Stuart can, because he'd just sort of wander in and stick his head through the door and go, are you having fun, guys? And then just leave. And it was sort of all very, oh, my God.
We had Stuart on the show. He's a great actor, very theatrical.
He's fantastic, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that was where we first became mates. And then I got a call from him, the very first Children in Need that was on Wogan's show. They wanted a super group. So they asked Stuart Copeland to do something. And Stu called me up and said, Mark, do you want to do this thing on Wogan tonight? It's... you know, I've got this song I've written. And this was really Stuart's, sort of alter ego, which was Clark Kent.
Clark Kent? Yeah.
And so, you know, and Mark Brzezicki played drums on that. And Stu was playing guitar, and he said, we need another guitar, Mark, you know, so I gave Nick Kershaw a call, and he came and did it. And then it was augmented, the sort of the fifth member of the band was Rowan Atkinson on tambourine. And that was it. And it was like...
Any good?
Do you know what? He was surprisingly good, and he took it incredibly seriously. And as it turned out, that Rowan's a big prog fan, so he was very much into, you know, into time signatures and all kinds of things. So he tambourine. Was taking it very seriously. There was no Mr. Bean with the whole thing.
He was doing 6:15 on the tambourine.
he was all over it, you know. It was great.
Bring us up to date. Are you at level 42 still in existence, or is it just you?
No. Level 42 are very much in existence. You know, my good buddy Mike Lindup, who I haven't seen since last March. You know, we were all set. The very day before lockdown came, we were in rehearsals for a show with the BBC Concert Orchestra at the Palladium in London. You know, we tour every 2 years, Gary, and last year would have been our 40th anniversary, and we had a whole 24 shows in the UK and another sort of 15 or so in Europe afterwards. So we still tour. We do festivals all the time. Obviously, the day before lockdown came in, we'd been in rehearsals, and then I just got a text from the BBC saying, you know, one of the orchestras has tested positive for COVID. Everything's off. And that was that. And then that was the start of this whole thing. I came home with my wife and my daughter, and we've been on the Isle of Wight ever since, you know, and I've just sort of seen things dry up. I'm very, very angry at how, you know, musicians and our sector of the industry has been kindly ignored, really, by the government and by furlough schemes and this, that and the other, because we do seem to have fallen through the cracks. And there's been no acknowledgement of the huge amounts of money that music and entertainment bring into the British economy.
Absolutely, absolutely. I know, we should fish if we fished.
And when it all gets going, it's going to be even harder travelling across Europe. So
All that's outrageous. Let's not even go there.
No, let's not even go there, because it is kind of depressing. But I am furious about it, you know. And when I learnt just 2 or 3 days ago that, in fact, the EU did offer, visa-free travel for performers, and the UK turned it down because it would mean that we'd have to reciprocate and let performers come into our country. And they've said, no, that's not going to happen, you know. So took back control. Anyway, changed the subject.
But having said that, just one positive note, that's there seems to be such a big groundswell of opposition to that I've got a feeling something might happen.
Well, you know, fingers crossed it does, because it can't go on like that, because, I talk with, I have a fantastic agent, Neil Warnock from UTA.
Yes, of course. I've known Neil for years.
You know, like I said, everything got put on hold. We had a Australasian tour. We had 10 shows in Japan, 3 shows in Australia, 1 in New Zealand, 1 in Singapore, and that all got pulled. That was for last May. And then it got moved to this year, and then it got moved again, because, of course, nothing really is going to happen. And, you know, fingers crossed we can get back out in October of this year. But I'm kind of not holding my breath, you know.
We booked our tour 3 times. We're kind of hoping summer.
Have you managed to be creative in your studio during this time?
Not at all, Gary. That's the really sort of scary thing, is because the way that the whole sort of COVID thing has affected me, is that it's been incredibly negative in terms of your confidence, and you it's because it's like you're there and you work. It's what I've done for 40 years, and I'm always looking towards the next shows, the next this, that, and the other, and that gets me going. And then when it stops, it's like the switch being thrown off. It really makes you feel like you're now worthless. That was it, mate. That was your lot. And that's how it sort of personally has felt to me. I know it's not like that in reality, and I keep having a chat with myself about it. But if you're asking, you know, if you want to know how I really feel about it, it's been very, very negative in terms of my sort of creative spark.
Yeah, and I mean, there is this three-way race, isn't there, between obviously COVID, the vaccine, and certain rock stars not making it to ever be coming on stage again. You know, we've got to free the world to get Mick Jagger back on stage one more time, you know.
Yeah,
I mean, I am
yeah.
fearful that there's a lot of people won't come back after all of this.
And that we're you know, it's like if this was the year, if 2020 was the year that never was, the reality is that actually we are all another year older. So it's all very well saying, okay, well, let's just write that one off and then we'll crack on again. But, you know, it's just another year gone. And, you know, it's like, it's cool by me because I've had a fantastic 40 years in the business. I mean, really, really, it doesn't owe me a thing. But I really do feel for so many great young musicians and young bands that really yeah. were having their time. You know, if I think of Idols, that they'd just really broken through and then bosh, all gone, you know. Mm-hmm. Nadine Shah, another friend of mine, she had a fantastic album out last year. And it just like, you can't tour it, you can't do anything with it. And and that's your time. That time's gone. It's not as if you can just put it on, you know, and say, right, let's start again then. No, it's gone, because that's old news.
It's been fantastic spending some time.
Really, really brilliant.
Lovely talking to you guys too. Tons of respect for both of you. You know, I know what it's like working in this business, and you know, you're both legends at what you do and stuff. So thank you. It's been a pleasure chatting to you.
Ah, what can you say, Mark? What a lovely, incredible bundle of energy.
Ah, he was a beautiful man. You know, sometimes I've not really known Mark. I've never really got to know him, and just met him that odd occasion. But yeah, so enthusiastic.
But I hope that works for our listeners, because that wasn't our usual. The chronological thing didn't really happen. We seemed to be jumping around. It's just, you know, it was a fun chat, right? Which is how we
know. You know what it was? It was kind of podcast fusion, really, wasn't it?
That's exactly what it was. And it's about time.
Well, anyway, thank you for listening to the show. And we should be back next week. You'll get us on all of those regular podcast channels. And want to say as well, thank you for getting us to number one in the charts.
Yes,
this week. Thank you
for making us number one. Wow.
Number one podcast.
Having a number one podcast, I think, is the middle-age equivalent of having a number one single.
Anyway, see you next week.
Good night from me.
Yes, good night from him.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.